Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Coming up, Michigan musicians honor the life and legacy of Detroiter Alan Barnes.
He was able to traverse genres effortlessly between funk, jazz, bebop, hip-hop, and beyond.
But first, joining us now, as they do on most Fridays, are Susan Demas, publisher of Inside Michigan Politics, and Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants. Primary turnout on Tuesday, 19% of all registered voters in Michigan. Might be mixing apples and oranges, but there was a 34% turnout for the presidential primary earlier this year. So what's that say about the level of interest in these congressional and state house races? Susan?
Well, it's sadly predictable and follows a trend that, you know, we had roughly 20% turnout in our primary. August tends to be one of the worst times to have a primary in Michigan. Our weather is finally starting to get good. People are looking at other things like getting their kids ready for school. And, you know, time and time again, we see this abysmal turnout. But, you know, I do think that 34% turnout for the presidential primary, that is more positive. And come November, we should see a pretty good turnout for that, certainly far exceeding 34%.
I was looking at the Secretary of State's website to find out what past turnouts have been. It's been as low as 15% back in 1990, and 88 it was 16.5%, 2014 it was 17.4%. So while 19% is bad, it could be worse. Ken, I want to talk to you about the first congressional district Republican primary. It was not won by the two men with legislative experience, but a former Marine Lieutenant General. What did you make of that race? The winner was Jack Bergman, which I admit I know next to nothing about Jack Bergman.
Well, I think there's a couple things there that are working. One is, you know, this sort of support for outsiders when it comes to national races, and congressional races are certainly somewhat national, at least in the sense you're electing somebody to the U.S. Congress. And both in that seat and over in the Thumb, where there was a Republican primary, the sort of outsiders prevail. But I don't want to make too much of that. I mean, in both cases, the victor did it with about 38-39%. You know, you have these crowded primaries where that can happen, and so it really gets cut up. But, you know, there's probably, those are the two sort of big takeaways, and up there in the first, and, you know, I think Susan has a pretty good handle on this, but the two incumbent office holders, Tom Casperson, the current office holder, Jason Allen, a former office holder, kind of beat each other up going into it. So,
Susan, I wanted to ask you about that, and the 10th is As Ken alluded to in the Thumb, the 10th Congressional District held by Candace Miller. She's retiring. In the first, we should say Dan Benishek is retiring. That's why they're open. A five-way Republican primary race in the 10th, and Paul Mitchell won that one. What do you make of that race?
Well, once again, you have a crowded primary. And so in that race, you only had three contenders that really rose to the top. Paul Mitchell, a businessman who had previously run in a different congressional district, the 4th district back in 2014, and was not successful. You had Phil Pavlow, who's a current state senator from St. Clair, and former Senator Alan Sanborn. And then you had a couple also rans. Paul Mitchell just dominated the airwaves. He was willing to spend heavily, as he did last time. But I think he learned from some of his mistakes. He had Candace Miller's ex-chief of staff as his chief advisor, which is helpful in the district. And the result was not very surprising.
Let's go to the first, Susan, your observations about Jack Bergman winning that Republican primary.
I spent a lot of time up in the first district back in June, both above and below the Mackinac Bridge. And I was really surprised how quiet the race was at that point. You know, I didn't see any TV ads or billboards. When I was asking people about the race, they were just not engaged. Then it got very heated very quickly with Allen and Casperson beating each other up, as Ken said. And I think that Jack Bergman was able to rise to the top. He was an outsider, attractive military background. And I think he was running a much better campaign below the surface than anyone realized.
Ken, the Detroit News and WDIV-TV released a poll this week. It showed that Governor Snyder's approval rating is below 40%. His disapproval ratings at 54% of likely voters. I know we're not even through the 2016 elections, but will Governor Snyder's legacy have an impact on the 2018 elections? And if so, in what way?
Well, I think there will be maybe a political impact rather than the word legacy. I mean, I think with this Flint situation, it's going to be a challenge for whoever the Republican nominee is to sort of fight that off. I mean, you know, has the Republican brand from a gubernatorial standpoint been damaged when it comes to that 2018 gubernatorial race? That's kind of takeaway I've had for some time on this whole Flint situation. Now, the Snyder polling, obviously, it's not great. You don't know if that changes over time. I just think as you get into the last couple of years of your last term as governor, no matter what, Flint aside, it's just tougher and tougher to advance a robust agenda through your last 2 years.
Susan?
Well, I think that 2010 was clearly a referendum on Jennifer Granholm. And I think 2018 will be a referendum on Rick Snyder. And by that time, perhaps his numbers have recovered. Perhaps Flint is in the rearview mirror. I tend to think it will still be an issue. And, you know, governors after two terms tend to struggle with favorability. People tend to tire of them and look for something new. So I fully expect that Snyder will be a huge issue in the 2018 election.
And finally, in the 8th Congressional District, Democrat Melissa Gilbert won the Democratic primary to challenge Republican incumbent Mike Bishop. Gilbert, the former Little House on the Prairie actor, says she's not healthy enough to run and says she will withdraw from the race. Democrats are scrambling to get information to the Secretary of State's office to get Gilbert off the ballot and the party's new choice, Susanna Shkreli, as a replacement. Mike Bishop, the incumbent, just must be chuckling right now. Regardless of how this turns out, does Bishop have anything to worry about at this point? Susan?
Well, in a year where Trump is pulling below Clinton at 10 points in August, if that holds, perhaps there could be a surprise, but it's highly unlikely. It's very difficult to mount a campaign for Congress this late in the game, which is what Shkreli has to do. And it's a district that's 55% Republican anyway.
Ken?
Well, Bishop can't take his eye off the ball, but I don't think he's in trouble here. I'm not happy with what's going on here, being able to sort of get off the ballot because you're saying you're physically unable to run. The Secretary of State's got to make a decision, and it's going to be precedent-setting. And I think the sort of integrity of the nomination process is at stake here. You know, it's one thing, and this is sort of a one-time unusual event, but my concern is the Secretary of State's got to make a ruling, and whatever it is, I think it's got to be done in such a way so that you avoid allowing this sort of physically unable to campaign become actually a political strategy that party can use down the road to get weak nominees off the ballot and replacing them with stronger ones. So the decision made by the Secretary of State here is going to be precedent-setting.
That's Ken Sikkema, Senior Policy Fellow at Public Sector Consultants. And we heard from Susan Demas, the publisher of Inside Michigan Politics, who joined us by Skype. Thank you both for talking with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
This is Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings, and every couple of weeks or so, we get together and look at a cocktail. Usually, we kind of look at news reports, too, to see what's going on that might put you in mind of a cocktail. So what were you reading this time?
Oh, all about those cherries that got dumped up in Traverse City area.
Right, because of the cherry marketing board and trying to keep prices up, but a lot of people were appalled.
I know I was, because I have the perfect thing to do with all those extra cherries.
Oh, yeah? What's that?
I like to make brandied cherries in the summer and use those all year long in cocktails. Brandied cherries are way more delicious than those artificially flavored and colored things we call maraschino cherries, and they really make cocktails amazing.
Is that a complicated recipe? How do you do that?
No, it's actually really easy. You're going to take one part of sugar, so say half a cup of sugar, half a cup of water, throw in a cinnamon stick or some cardamom pods or some cloves if you like it, bring it up to a boil on your stove. As soon as it boils and all the sugar dissolves, just turn it off. You can let it sit for a little while to let those cinnamon and clove absorb into the simple syrup, so maybe 5 minutes. Then you're going to add a cup of brandy or some other kind of spirit that you like. Could be bourbon or rye. And then you're just going to pour that over some cherries in a canning jar. Let it cool to room temperature, then store it in the refrigerator, and it'll keep you in cherries for a good long time.
How long do they keep?
They'll definitely keep for a few months. If they start getting shriveled up and bubbly and don't taste very good, throw them away. But I've kept mine around for a while. I couldn't really give you an exact shelf life. Use your nose and your tongue.
And what do you use the cherries in?
Well, the drink that we think of when we think of a cherry garnish is the Manhattan cocktail. And this isn't really a great summer cocktail, but it is going to be a great cocktail in the fall when you'll still have these cherries around.
I know in one of your classes one time we had a Manhattan lab, which was fascinating how many different variations. So it's a flexible drink to a degree, but always tasty.
Absolutely. And today I made for you the classic Manhattan recipe. And so that's just two parts of rye whiskey, one part of sweet vermouth, two dashes of Angostura bitters, and we're going to stir that with some ice till it's good and chilled. Pour it into a glass and garnish it with those brandy cherries.
Well, that sounds great. Thanks.
Cheers.
Up next, Fracture, a new book of essays, stories, and poems that takes on fracking in America. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. In the last decade, the term fracking has become part of the national lexicon. Fracking, hydraulic fracturing, has actually been around for decades. It's a method of extracting natural gas or oil by drilling down into the rock, sending a viscous fluid under pressure, fracturing the rock. That allows the fossil fuel to escape, and then it's pumped out. The reason it started to become more well-known is because of a development called horizontal hydraulic fracturing, and that's changed the whole scenery. Instead of just drilling down, technology was developed to turn the drill bit horizontally and frack along the rock for long distances. It also led to more complaints about contaminated water wells, in some cases some minor earth tremors, and it also requires a lot more fracking fluid. That means a lot more water, and it mixes with chemicals, and once it's retrieved, it's no longer usable. That has a lot of people more than a little concerned. A new book, a collection of essays, stories, and poems about fracking is out. It's called Fracture. The anthology was edited by Taylor Brorby and Stephanie Brooke Trout. Stephanie Brooke Trout joins us now along with Marianne Lessert, an associate professor at Grand Rapids Community College, who wrote one of the stories in Fracture. Stephanie Brooke Trout, you gathered almost 50 writers for this project. Why did you think this collection was necessary?
Well, Lester, we knew that the public needed to know more information about fracking, but at the same time, we knew that the public needed artistic representations of fracking. The poems, the essays, the short stories in this collection, they're everything that headline news isn't. And they really give you the sense of the personal experience of fracking, whether we're talking about the roughnecks actually working in the field or the landowners who now have drilling on their land or are experiencing some of the consequences from a pipeline leak. So we wanted to collect as many diverse perspectives as possible on the issue, really to just show the public how complex the issue is and get us out of this two-sided framework. Fracking is good, we've been doing it for decades, or, you know, fracking bad, and to really unpack the issue and give people a sense of the real experience of it.
Stephanie, what do you think these writers have said that we haven't heard in the past?
Well, the writers have said fracking is not just an environmental issue. It's not just a political issue. Fracking is a personal issue, and it's touching their family lives. It's affecting their employment. It's affecting their personal relationships, friendships, fallouts. It is more than just what we hear in the headlines and from the sound bites.
Marianne Lessert, your story is fictional, but the descriptions in it hint you've spent some time around some fracking sites or former fracking sites. Is that right?
That's correct. As a writer, I went out, and I kind of affectionately now call it my boots on well sites research stage. I spent some time reading all the science about fracking, understanding the process, and then what I really wanted to do was write from a more sensory level. What's it like to live with fracking? So I spent a lot of time with people living next door to frack well sites, being out on the sites themselves, talking to people in the industry, seeing, smelling, hearing, you know, feeling the drill rig vibrating through your body kind of thing.
Would you read just a bit of your story for us?
Sure. I'll read the opening paragraph, which is the ultimate out of balance. We came to know that fracking can look uglier and uglier depending on who, ultimately, is in charge. From the rusty sheet metal welded to the framework of their 136-foot-tall monster of a drill rig, to the messes they left behind, Dillon sites, we soon discovered, were pure carelessness and slop.
So when you visited these sites, what was the thing that struck you the most?
One of the things that I found that was really, really important as a researcher was meeting people who were living near these sites. And there are people that have stuck in my mind for years. And I think about those people and how much they really felt that telling their story about what fracking was really like instead of reducing it to, I mean, I know we need science. We absolutely need science. But they also wanted people to understand just how different their lives became. For instance, an elderly couple living in Kalkaska County, Phyllis and Bernard. I met them in June 2013, and when I walked up, they were all bent over their water well with their water well driller, watching their pump suck air. There was an Encana well site around the bend bordering their property. The fracking operation had demanded several water wells to be drilled, and their water well was literally running dry. The other thing that was happening is the silica sand was literally pluming up for 20 and 30 feet into the air and falling like huge clouds onto the neighbor's house. Their neighbors had been evacuated because the yellow-white dust of the silica sand covered their home. And so I spent the day with these people who were, first of all, afraid to touch the tap water out of their own tap for fears of chemical contamination, and then it ran dry or at least was filled with air. And the other thing was they could see visible evidence right in front of them, a 20, 30-foot tall plume of silica dust that I photographed over their heads by their small wood meadow farm sign. You know, and it's that idea that home is not home anymore, that your absolute sense of home is shaken.
Stephanie Brookkraut, you not only were a co-editor, but you also contributed to the collection. Basically, your essay starts out, why we don't want to hear about fracking. Would you read a little bit about that and then kind of summarize your points for us?
Absolutely. So my piece is called Hear No Evil, and it's sort of a list, 10 reasons why we don't want to hear about fracking. And this is reason number 5. We don't want to hear about fracking because we don't like your alternative. If the solution could somehow be linked to consumerism, if we could do the things we love without fracking, we might be more inclined to listen. But you are asking too much. Your valuation of the future is too high. Some of the other reasons in the list, the third reason is the not in my backyard argument, which is, you know, sure, we don't want this in our backyard. We don't want our own watersheds contaminated with fracking fluids, but, you know, as long as it's somewhere else, somewhere that doesn't matter, then it's okay.
Out of sight, out of mind.
Exactly. Yeah.
I saw Bill McKibben not only submitted a piece, but his group 350.org, which is a climate change movement, was a partner in putting out this collection. He's pushing to find ways to limit the use of fossil fuels, but the argument is made that natural gas emissions account for half the carbon output of a fuel such as coal. Is fracking an inevitable interim step that the market forces require? Marianne, would you address that question?
Well, I don't know if I can answer, you know, from a market forces perspective, but I do know that one of the things that's sometimes misleading about the language is the idea of natural gas being a cleaner burner. And, you know, from what I've seen, smelled, tasted in the air, there's a whole lot of off-gassing from all of these valves, wellheads, tanks, things that happen on site. And when you study the whole range of things that happen in fracking, from the original drilling to the storage to the movement of liquid and dry gas to the processing, there's a lot of studies that have shown that there's a whole lot more methane and volatile organic compounds getting off-gassed into the air, which in a net way makes natural gas not cleaner. I guess in a market capacity, I, as a consumer, as somebody who wants to buy clean energy, I would love to see us devote our talents and our innovations, which I know we have, to local, community-owned sources of power, wind, solar, cleaner technologies.
Stephanie, I'll ask the same question. I mean, we've got this cheap natural gas because of fracking, and people like it. They like the cheaper parts. We see coal-burning power plants shutting down and switching to natural gas because it's cheaper. Is this an interim step that's just going to happen no matter how much opposition there is to fracking?
Well, I think those are sort of two different questions, whether or not this is going to be an interim step versus whether or not it is wise for this to be an interim step. Natural gas does emit less carbon into the atmosphere, but it emits much more methane, which is a much more dangerous and more powerful greenhouse gas. Also, when we talk about it being cheaper, we're talking about the cost of extraction alone. We're not talking about the cost of the fallout, the public health hazards, the cleanup. We just had news of the Enbridge pipeline spill from 2010 just reached a $177 million settlement, which is the largest penalty for a Clean Water Act violation in U.S. history. That doesn't sound cheaper to me.
I saw on your website, Stephanie, that StephanieBrookTrout.com, that you've been doing readings and book signings. What kind of response are you getting from the people you're seeing?
We're getting an incredibly powerful response. People are really excited to be learning more about the issue and to be really learning more than just the science, but more about the personal experience, more about the history. People want to have real conversations about these issues and not just sort of a back and forth shouting each other down. Neither side is going to give an inch, but to actually discuss these issues that are affecting our state and our country and our world.
That's Stephanie Brooke Trout and Marianne Lesser. That book is Fracture, a collection of essays, poems, and stories on fracking in America. They will be appearing in Traverse City at Horizon Books on Saturday, August 6th. You'll both be there, right?
Absolutely, correct. Along with Stephanie Mills.
And Tuesday, August 9th, they'll be in Pellston at the University of Michigan Biological Station. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having us, Lester.
Thank you, Lester.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Last week, Michigan lost a Detroit musician near and dear to many. Saxophonist and flutist Alan Barnes unexpectedly died at the age of 66. A founding member of the Blackbirds, Barnes grew up and evolved with the music around him, from jazz to funk and then hip-hop and even electronica. Barnes became a nexus for musicians and music lovers around the state. There's a musical celebration tonight at Burt's Warehouse in Detroit's Eastern Market to honor his legacy. Metro Detroit drummer and founding member of the Gorilla Funk Mob, Tate McBroom, began playing with Barnes about a decade ago and shares this remembrance with us.
First time I heard Alan Barnes was when I was working at WIDR in Kalamazoo, Western Michigan's student-run radio station. My partner at the time, Vonzell Reed, who I was doing a show with, introduced me to the Blackbirds records for the first time, and the whole catalog of Donald Byrd, Stepping Into Tomorrow, Blackbird, Street Lady, that whole thing. When I heard the Blackbirds, I was really taken with their sound and with their musicianship and the cohesion of the music they made, both on Flying Start and on the first Blackbirds record, which is, you know, the only two records that Alan played on from that era. The first time I played with Alan was in 2007 for the Detroit Electronic Music Festival with Malik Alston. He put a big band together, and I was playing drums, Alan was playing sax and flute. And shortly thereafter, I hired Alan to work with us for the City Fest, which Gorilla Front Mob had been asked to play, but had been asked to get a featured artist to perform with us. And after that time, I continued to play with Alan for another 9 years. And we played together in prime time, his band at Baker's for the last 6 years, Gorilla Funk Mob on and off for that entire duration. And we put a group together called the Blackbird Review, which was doing music of Donald Byrd, the Blackbirds, and Fonts and Larry Mizell, two of the main co-writers and producers of that whole era. So we played together probably 150 times over the last 9 years, and every single time I played with him, I got better as a musician. Influence on the Detroit music scene is, in a word, profound. He was the link between Donald Byrd and J. Dilla. He was revered and loved within the electronic music community as he recorded with Carl Craig and the Interzone Orchestra and the Detroit Experiment and many, many other projects. He was able to traverse genres effortlessly between funk, jazz, bebop, hip-hop, and beyond. He had so much more he wanted to do and was getting ready to do. But the body of work he left us will stand the test of time. One of his favorite sayings was, "The music is more realer than the people." And he proved that with his body of work in his lifetime. If I had to choose one song for everyone to hear to sum up who Alan Barnes was as a person, as a musician, as a friend, I would say that track would be Midnight at the 20 Grand off the Detroit Experiment Project. In that song, when the flute comes in at the beginning, you can hear his kindness. You can hear the spiritual nature of who he was. And you can hear the humanity in the performance. It is a powerful, powerful song. This Friday at Burt's Warehouse Theater in Eastern Market, Detroit, we will be having the Alan Barnes Detroit Salute Benefit Concert. 100% of proceeds go to benefit his family, go directly to his family to help pay for funeral expenses this week. We did not expect to have this conversation this early. Alan was 66 years old. His family has done a marvelous job this week, so we're going to do everything we can to hold them up and to support them in this time of bereavement. The concert will feature performances from Gorilla Funk Mob, Finale, Big Tone, Poetic, John Cloud, and Super MC for a one-hour hip-hop tribute set to the artists who recorded records and had features with Alan. Immediately following the Gorilla Funk Mob set, we will have a two-and-a-half-hour open jazz jam session, which will feature some of the greatest Detroit musicians Alan ever worked with and some of his closest friends. It will be a truly epic night in remembrance of one of Detroit's greatest musical sons, Alan Curtis Bonds.
Still to come, Lake Michigan and the Second World War. A new documentary explains how dozens of planes ended up on the bottom of the lake. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Michigan State University and Wayne State University are among the latest schools to stop requiring algebra for all students. Some students, such as engineering and other STEM students, will still have to take algebra and a lot of other math. But if you're a history major or an English major, for example, algebra might not be required. To talk about that, we got a hold of Vince Melfi. He's an associate professor in the Department of Statistics and Probability at the Program in Mathematics and Education at Michigan State University. So what's the reason behind dropping the algebra requirement at MSU?
Well, I would kind of phrase it somewhat differently. It's kind of modifying the requirement since the courses that students can take will still involve algebra. But kind of the reasoning is that students in majors such as engineering or physics or economics need a solid understanding of traditional mathematical areas like calculus and linear algebra. But other majors, for example, history, journalism, things like that, are different in some important ways. One is that typically advanced courses in the major aren't very quantitative in nature, and so the university requirements are going to typically provide the main exposure to mathematical sciences for those students. And so it's really important that those courses provide not only technical skills, but also examples of mathematics applied to real-world problems. And then in addition, in those majors, rather than calculus, those students are really well served by learning tools that help them understand and work with data to be able to make decisions when uncertainty is present, as is true in lots of the real-world contexts that they'd be working in.
I want to pursue that a little bit because, you know, I've heard a lot of people say, yeah, I took algebra. I've never used it since. But, you know, if there are eight slices for each pizza and you've got 22 kids and you want to make sure each kid gets three slices, you've got to solve for X. Or if you're buying a car and one dealer offers 2% off, another offers $1,500. You've got to use algebra to determine which is the better deal. This is everyday life where, you know, you might be an English major or an engineer, but you should be, as a college-educated person, considered well-educated. How can they be if they don't have some algebra?
Oh, no disagreement here. And as I said, the new courses will, in fact, involve algebra, but will also have, for example, more data analysis, more probability modeling. So one of the guiding principles behind the courses we developed here is that the real-world context, and there I'm thinking of things like health and risk or politics and voting or finance and economics, really drives the development of the mathematical tools rather than the typical sort of, I mean, what you were talking about, sort of story problems, and sort of the way people think of those is, yeah, I learn all of this algebra and then I get these, you know, four kind of crazy and unrealistic story problems about pizza, and that's the connection with the real world. And in our courses, we start with a real world context. So maybe we start with, for example, screening for breast cancer or screening for HIV, and based on that context, we develop the mathematics and then come back to the context and really emphasize that mathematics is only part of what you need to understand in order to really address the questions. You know, should I be screened? Should society be paying for screening? You know, that's one of the real distinctions between what we're trying to do here and what typically happens in an algebra class.
It was suggested that this has to do with college-age students not getting sufficient math skills in high school, and that's why these kinds of changes are being made at universities or dropping algebra requirements. Is that a factor?
No, I don't think it's a factor. Typically, students in Michigan have taken algebra in high school, and so they come in with reasonably strong skills in algebra, and we were really focused on what the next step should be. And so if you're going to major in engineering, then the next step is to really solidify those algebra skills so that you can then go on to take calculus where those algebra skills really are quite important. If you're majoring in a different discipline where data are more important, then you can use those algebra skills to learn about statistics or to learn about probability modeling, and not focus so much on just improving your procedural skills in algebra.
Now, we'll follow it up with, I saw in a news story, that part of what was behind that was that MSU students, and I assume students at other universities, have a hard time passing college algebra. Was that a factor in this decision to offer these other courses?
It is true that students here and at many institutions struggle with college algebra, and part of that is the relevance question, right? Because algebra, as it is often taught, is taught as a more abstract mathematical discipline, and especially students who aren't majoring in an area where they'll be using algebra in their major wonder why they are learning these topics. And in addition, algebra, as developed, was a discipline to solve real-world problems. And we've, to some extent, gotten away from that in the way we teach algebra, both in high school and in college.
Are universities around the world doing this, or is this just an American phenomenon?
There is more focus on topics like data and reasoning with uncertainty worldwide. In fact, I was just reading a monograph written by two distinguished French mathematicians, and they were talking about sort of which areas of mathematics they thought were most important for what they called mathematical culture, and they were really talking about you know what they thought an educated citizen should know. And they emphasized probability modeling and reasoning with uncertainty as really the area that they thought people were weakest in and really needed to know in order to kind of function in the modern world.
So you're saying it is something that other universities...
It is not just an American phenomenon.
Right.
Yes.
We've been talking with Vince Melfi. He's a math professor at Michigan State University. We've been talking about dropping the requirement for algebra, but requiring other kinds of math that might work in the real world for students. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. When Pearl Harbor was attacked by the Japanese in 1941, America was pulled into World War II in a big way. But the military needed, among a lot of other things, pilots. In particular, the U.S. needed pilots who could land and take off from aircraft carriers. But the carriers the U.S. had at the time were desperately needed in the theater. So how do you train the pilots? That is the topic of a new documentary, Heroes on Deck, World War II on Lake Michigan. Joining us now is John Davies. He's the director. This is a part of history not a lot of people know about. I first learned about it because of a small display at the old Meigs Airfield Terminal in Chicago before, you know, Merritt Daly tore it up. How did you first learn about this training?
Well, I was in 1988. I was working at WTTW Chicago, the public television station.
Sure, there. Windows to the World, yeah.
Window to the World Communications, as a young producer. And one night I was stopped off for a drink in a bar called the North Side. It was a big hang for people in media. And a guy sitting next to me, after a few hours, looked over at me. He said, you know, there's 100 World War II planes sitting on the bottom of Lake Michigan, don't you? And I said, no, I had no idea. But I couldn't stop thinking about it. And remember, this is before the Internet. So I made a few calls, found a researcher in Washington, D.C. named Polly Pettit, and hired her to go and look in the National Archives. She called me a couple of days later and said, John, there's a lot of material on this.
Right.
Including a color film. So I ended up making a little doc about it at the time with very few resources, not enough money, underpaid producer guy, and really wasn't a very good documentarian back then. So I made it. It was called Top Guns of 43. I had a chance to remake it a few years ago with a lot more financial resources, and I'm just a better filmmaker now. And we decided to do the ultimate telling of this story and to buy everything they had at the National Archives as opposed to just the one or two things I could afford back in 88.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what was going on. As I mentioned, U.S. carriers were needed in the theater immediately. People got creative and used a couple of Great Lakes passenger steamers. How do you convert a passenger steamer into an aircraft carrier?
Well, remarkably, they did it in just a few months. I mean, there are obviously some great designers working for the U.S. Navy because they figured out how to do it. They found the biggest ships they could because they wanted to come up with the longest flat tops they could put on these things. These two old passenger ships were like luxury ships on the order of the Titanic in terms of the interior. And they had been used by passengers to cruise the Great Lakes in style. And when you look back at the prices, boy, it was cheap back then, $59 for a seven-day cruise. But anyway, the Navy had their structural engineers go in, rip off the upper decks where all the passenger cabins were, and put a gigantic 500-foot-long flat top on it, a runway, basically, and put them out in the middle of Lake Michigan and started training over 15,000 pilots in 2.5 years.
And I saw in one of your releases they called them freshwater flat tops. Why Lake Michigan?
Well, Lake Michigan, they felt, was, as we say in the movie, you were never going to see any Japanese or German U-boats in Lake Michigan. And it was a safety factor, and they realized that they couldn't pull the real carriers out of service, as you said in your opening, to train guys. First of all, ships have to move in a zigzag when they're at war so they don't get shot by submarines. So they couldn't really pull them out of service, and somebody came up with this idea, a former Great Lakes steamship captain, one of the guys who captained one of the two boats that were converted, came up with the idea. He said, why not do it in the safety of Lake Michigan? We'll just convert these steamships and it'll be safe. And all the pilots that I interviewed said, even though it wasn't the ocean, it still gave them a real dose of what it was going to be like to land on a carrier in the middle of a giant body of water.
Tell us the names of those two boats.
When they were steamships, they were the Greater Buffalo and the C&B. And when they were commissioned by the Navy, they became the USS Wolverine and the USS Sable.
How many pilots ended up being trained on Lake Michigan?
Well, the estimates are slightly over 15,000. And the majority of them went to the Pacific Theater, but some did go to the Atlantic. And even a few Canadians and Brits also trained on those ships. And President George Herbert Walker Bush.
Right. Navy pilot got shot down and saved by a sub, as I recall.
Yep.
I read crashes and water landings often led to serious injuries, occasionally death. How many pilots ended up dying? And you said 100 fighter planes ended up in the bottom of Lake Michigan?
Yeah, their estimates are from all the logs and that have been gone through, a little over 100 went in. Actually, more than that went in, but some of them were plucked out of the water right away because it was near the shoreline. You could see them, or they were floating on top, and they had a boat called the Commerce that tooled around following the carriers, hoping to rescue anything that went into the water. And they did rescue a lot, but over 100 went to the bottom, basically of five different types of planes, four of which were used in combat. Of the pilots that went in, they estimate about 8 or 9 guys actually died, which, if you think about it, for any military training exercise with 15,000 people involved, believe it or not, that's a low figure. It's really incredible that they didn't lose more. This is a 7-day-a-week operation, including during winter. And if a guy went into the water in the winter, oh my God, he only had about 10 minutes before he'd die of exposure.
I understand your documentary not only covers the history, the training, but also the recovery of some of those planes and the restoration. Tell me about that.
Well, that's what triggered me remaking the original movie I had made in 1988. One of the guys who'd edited that movie with me, Harvey Moshman, my partner on the new film, Heroes on Deck, he became a diver in the interim between 88 and 2000, and he started diving on the wrecks with one of the companies that was approved by the U.S. Navy for retrieval. And the only reason the U.S. Navy retrieves these is to place them in museums and airports all over the U.S. So Harvey started calling me up and saying, John, you should consider remaking Top Guns of 43. I've got this great high-def footage I've been shooting. The planes look incredible. They come out of the water. It's a media extravaganza every time one of them breaks the surface. Why don't we remake it? And he really pushed me. And so we did what producers always do. We wrote a 2-page treatment. We made a heck of a sizzle reel. And we went out and started selling. And we got 6 no's. And the number 7 person we went to said yes and wrote the check for the whole thing. And his name is Captain Dave Truitt of the Chicago Marine Heritage Society.
Well, you've got a lot of talented people involved in this project, but I noticed it's narrated by legendary CBS and A&E newsman Bill Curtis.
This film contains rare footage of a U.S. Navy operation just off Chicago's shoreline that changed the course of World War II.
I should note, you might also know Bill Curtis from his role on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Tell me how important the role of the narrator is in a documentary like this.
Well, it's kind of everything, and I do a doc about once every 5 years. I always like to know who I'm going to hire as the narrator as I'm writing, because I hear their voice in my head then. And also, I'm a heavily scripted documentary guy. I like documentaries with narration. A lot of people don't. They say it's unnatural, but I like docs with narration. So I have to hear the narrator in my head, and I heard Bill Curtis's voice for this, and I actually wrote it even knowing some of his expressions. And so when he said yes, it was like, all right, we got Bill Curtis, and he just knocked it out of the park. To take Bill, he can do a whole one-hour narration track in about 35 minutes. I mean, it's just, he blows through it. But it's so good. He'd always offer to do another take, and we'd be, the first two were great.
Now, when and where can we see Heroes on Deck?
Heroes on Deck is being distributed by American Public Television, and it's on various public TV stations all over the nation, and they're going to have it for 2 years. We always notice a spike in the DVD sales when they run it because they often run it on a military holiday like Memorial Day, Veterans Day, July 4th. That's where it seems to do best for everyone. I mean, it really looks great big. We kind of made it with big in mind, and we retransferred all the old footage to high def. And some of the footage for this movie is, as you can imagine, it's great. This is a great story that hardly anybody really knows about in the U.S. And when you see the film, you're like, wow, what a, you know, it's very hard for me to find stories this good. I lucked out with this one. You know, every now and then you just find that perfect storm of a story where you got the footage, you still got some of the people alive, and it's just, I've been fascinated by it since 1988, and I'm still fascinated by it. And when you see these planes sitting on the bottom, you're like, cool.
That's John Davies. He's the director of the new documentary, Heroes on Deck, World War II on Lake Michigan. Thanks for talking with us.
Hey, guys. Thank you.
The 2016 Summer Olympic Games begin tonight in Rio de Janeiro. From volleyball to rowing to track and field, there are more than 40 Michigan Olympians competing this year. Some either went to school or trained here, but many were born here, like Canton swimmer Allison Schmidt, Saginaw basketball player Draymond Green, and Flint boxer Clarissa Shields. Here's the boxer talking to Cynthia Canty back in 2015 about what winning the gold medal in 2012 meant to her and the folks back in Flint.
To me, it represents hope, and it brings a lot of faith, you know. Of course, I'm from Flint, and we have a high murder rate, but there's a lot of talent, and there's a lot of great people here in the city of Flint, Michigan. And when I won the gold, it just showed that, because so many people feel like their life is over, you know, feel like they don't have anything to fight for, or like they just can't be anything because where we're from and where we're always around. So when I won the Olympics, it made everybody happy.
Before heading off to the Olympic trials last fall, Shields told us how she prepares for a fight.
Mentally, anything that, you know, makes me think negative or makes me sad or mad, I just stay away from it. You know, right now I'm just getting rid of all doubt. I'm making sure that I check everything I have to check, that I'm in shape, that I'm eating right, that I'm mentally sane, that I'm physically ready.
21-year-old boxer Clarissa Shields from Flint, Michigan will have her first fight on Wednesday, August 17th. The Rio Olympics opening ceremony begins at 7:30 tonight on NBC. Stateside's producers are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, and Lindsay Scullin. The executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.